Hello, it's Thursday night, October 19th, 2000, and this is Little Brother. This is episode 1 of Little Brother, and tonight we'll be introducing ourselves, talking about carnivore, digital bank robberies, digital TV, gun control, overzealous lawyers, and a lot more. So stay tuned, because Little Brother is about to tell on Big Brother. Hello, and thanks for tuning in to episode 1 of Little Brother, the show where we talk about hacking, telephone systems, computer systems, and of course we tell on Big Brother. If you like this show, I'd like you to ask that you please feel free to copy it to whatever medium you choose, propagate it as far and wide as you can. I want this show to get out there. This radio program is open sourced. Take any portion, make any derivative work you will from it, just as long as what you make out of it is also open sourced. Most of you will be hearing this program streamed over the internet as a 16 kbps MP3 file. If you'd like a better sounding copy of it, please contact me. Contact information will be given out at the end of the show. So, with a quick nod to Amy Goodman, the boldest journalist that I know of, and Emmanuel Goldstein, the king of hackers, I give you episode 1 of Little Brother. The Federal Bureau of Investigations released the first set of documents concerning its carnivore internet surveillance system on October 2nd. The documents were released as a result of the Electronic Privacy Information Center's Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the FBI and the Department of Justice. Of the 729 pages of material processed, nearly 200 were withheld in full, and another 400 were released with deletions. The documents reveal the surveillance system's origins, contain discussions of interception of voice over IP, and describe various testing procedures. The newly released documents confirm that Carnivore grew out of an earlier FBI project called Omnivore, and revealed for the first time that Omnivore itself replaced an older surveillance tool. The name of the earlier project has been blacked out of the documents and remains classified. In September 1998, the FBI's Data Intercept Technology Unit in Quantico, Virginia, launched a project to migrate Omnivore from Sun's Solaris operating system to a Windows NT platform. Quote, "This will facilitate the miniaturization of the system and support a wide range of personal computer equipment," end quote, according to the project's statement of need. The project was called Fippletrinix, and the resulting system was named Carnivore. Fippletrinix's estimated price tag of $800,000 included training for personnel at the Bureau's National Infrastructure Protection Center, or NIPC. The Omnivore project was formally closed down in June 1999 at a final cost of $900,000. Carnivore version 1.2 was released in September 1999. As of May 2000, it was in version 1.3.4. At that time, it was subjected to an exhaustive series of carefully prescribed tests under variable conditions. The results, according to an internal memo, were positive. Quote, "Carnivore is remarkably tolerant of network aberrations such as speed change, data corruption, and targeted Smurf-type attacks," end quote. An enhanced Carnivore project began in November 1999 and is scheduled to conclude in January of next year, at a total cost of $650,000. Some of the documents indicate that the Bureau plans to add more features to versions 2.0 and 3.0 of Carnivore, but the details have mostly been redacted. The next installment of Carnivore documents is scheduled to be released to the Epic in mid-November. Epic has posted scanned images of the selected documents at www.epic.org. And we have another item on Carnivore. Apparently, the Department of Justice attempted to hide the identity of the Carnivore review team members at IITRI However, the censored information was extracted from a PDF file with a little Adobe hacking, and the unexpurgated version appears on Krypton.com. This item was submitted to the Risks Digest by Mina van der Meulen. Italian police stopped digital bank robbery. The robbers had hacked the computer system of the Banca di Sicilia and had almost started booking more than $500,000, 2 trillion lira, to other bank accounts. The Italian paper La Repubblica says that the group aimed at European money designated for the regional administration of Sicily. Apparently, the group also had plans to rob the Vatican Bank, the IOR. The police arrested 21 persons, mafiosi, computer experts, and corrupt bank employees. They were charged with money laundering, attempted burglary, and connection with the mafia. Most of them come from Palermo. With the cooperation of employees of the bank, the group made a computer system that looks exactly like the bank's and could connect to the bank's network after closing time. Bank employees provide the necessary passwords. The police caught the bank robbers with the help of some telephone taps. The Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, issued a ruling on September 18th that allows Hollywood to require the manufacturers of digital VCRs, high-definition TVs, cable set-top boxes, and related equipment to implement copy restriction technology into the devices. Hollywood's latest attack on civil liberties limits the public's ability to make fair use of digital programming by imposing restrictive licensing schemes on the device manufacturers. Just as they impose a CSS license on the makers of DVD players that forbids any recording functionality to consumer, Hollywood now wants to impose such a scheme on digital TVs, VCRs, and other viewing and recording equipment. The U.S. Supreme Court stated plainly in the Betamax case that the recording of programs for later viewing in the privacy of the user's home is a non-commercial use permitted by fair use doctrine. By inserting instructions into the digital programming stream that are obeyed by the hardware, the studios are able to control the public's ability to save or copy programming. Since the devices will only permit the consumer to copy the content that the studios code as copyable, not likely to be much, if anything, the public's fair use rights would effectively be extinguished in the digital television realm. The Electronic Frontier Foundation submitted September 7, 2000, comments to the FCC pursuant to its original notice of proposed rulemaking, and it can be found at www.eff.org. This item was submitted to the Risks Digest by Philip Musumeci. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation is the national broadcaster of Australia. It uses innovative digital audio systems in-house and supplies streaming audio feeds of its major network's programs. During the Olympics, its news radio network had to cut its streaming audio broadcast in order to comply with the Olympics organizers' arrangements for the sale of coverage. So in addition to the Olympics organization scanning internet sites for diaries and chats, Australians had a 16-day blackout on one of their ABC network's streaming audio feeds. An online gaming fan has been hit with a $6,000 invoice from Earthlink and is set to receive another for $24,000, all for posting a movie of upcoming Bungie Xbox title Halo on his personal website. The movie is a copy of an NVIDIA advertisement that features Halo in action running on the 3D company's hardware. The ad appeared in July 2000 and was shown at Macworld Expo in New York. U.S.-based Halo fan Cannibal Harry picked up the ad, digitized it, and posted it on his website in two versions, a 45 and a 32 megabyte version. The bills resulted from the 62 gigabytes of traffic in downloads during July and 4,500 gigabytes during September, when his monthly limit is 500 megabytes. Steve Bilovins submits to Risks Digest, an AP review describes a new Intel product aimed at children called the Play Computer Sound Morpher. It's a microphone plus software to change the recorded voices. It also lets you save the sound creations to email them to somebody as an executable file with both the message and a player. The next sentence of the review started with a word of caution, but of course, it was a warning about the file size rather than the habit and consequences of emailing executables. Thomas Roessler writes in Risks Digest, Frequently, you read about the importance of policies, version control, and so on for corporate IT security and management. But you also regularly read about corporations finding huge amounts of pirated software on their employees' PCs and about employees not adhering to policies, eventually endangering a corporation's IT security as a whole. One of the reasons for this kind of misbehavior may lie in the lack of ease of use of and functionality with official IT environments, combined with the ease of administration with PCs running single-user operating systems. When users have easy access to webmail systems, but the internal mail system happens to work flawlessly only on an occasional basis, don't be too astonished if your employees start to discuss confidential internal issues through Yahoo and Hotmail. When the office email system doesn't work reliably and timely for external messages or has an interface which is worse than Hotmail, don't be astonished if your employees give out private email addresses to customers, as in, well, if you want to get through quickly and reliably, use such and such at yahoo.com. It's not official, but it works. When customers send messages in the office format of the day and employees can't read them, don't be astonished if you happen to find pirated copies of the latest releases of that software in question on their computers. So when thinking about security, always keep in mind that you need an environment that works well enough to be accepted by your users. If it isn't accepted, they'll sooner or later find ways to work around it and around all your nicely established policies and procedures. And you don't want to spend your time securing an environment that isn't really used, right? I would hope that I've spent the last 90 seconds stating the obvious. However, in reality, all of what I'm describing happens on a daily basis. Just look. Laundry hampers, if used as intended, pose a serious efficiency problem. When the hamper fills, one usually empties it, sorts the items within, and washes the sorted items by group. Now suppose, as is usually the case, you don't have enough of a group of items to make it worthwhile to run a load. Usually, you just dump the unprocessed laundry back into the hamper. This typically results in extremely rank clothes when they do not get washed and can cause zombie clothes to accumulate in the bottom untouched for weeks. So here's the solution. Stack processed laundry. The procedure. Have one stack for each type of load. Whites, lights, darks, etc. When undressing, put each item on the appropriate stack. Items closer to the top are less dirty than those closer to the bottom. When dressing, pop the stack until you find something that's both something you didn't wear yesterday or the day before and isn't stinky or visibly dirty. Else, get something fresh from the drawer or closet. Push back any popped items. When any stack reaches a certain size or the buffer of clean clothes gets close to empty, put that stack in the washing machine. If you allow the clean clothes buffer to empty completely, the corresponding dirty stack will overwrite that buffer, causing you to have to wear dirty clothes. Using multiple stacks of laundry instead of a single heap that is a typical laundry hamper brings the following benefits. 1. There's no need to sort when processing laundry, as this is done when pushing items onto the stack. This also eliminates repeated sorts that just get jumbled again when the laundry is returned to the heap because there isn't enough to fill a load. 2. Avoid allowing zombie laundry to ferment unprocessed in the bottom of the hamper. Be a true geek and use stack processed laundry. From the Liberator Online, gun rights advocates often claim that licensing, registration, and other gun control measures are really just steps towards total or near-total gun confiscation, and that gun control advocates will never be satisfied with anything short of that. More evidence for that view comes from Britain. Britain recently enacted draconian control laws, some of the strictest in the world, but British gun controllers apparently aren't satisfied even with that. The Labour government is now proposing severe new regulations on the ownership of shotguns. Currently, around 500,000 citizens own shotguns in Britain. Laws passed in 1988 give police the power to refuse to issue a certificate permitting ownership if they could show sufficient reason. The proposed new laws would reverse that. Owners will have to provide officials with good reason why they should be allowed to possess a shotgun. Applicants for ownership permits will be forced to provide a detailed character reference. Police will be able to confiscate licenses and guns from those they deem unqualified. The number of shotguns that can be owned using a single license will be limited. Ownership age will be raised. Ironically, Britain has been enjoying a large decrease in the use of shotguns in crime from one-third of all gun crimes in 1988 to only 12% in 1998, less than 500 crimes a year. Government spokesman Charles Clark defended the measure in words that meddlers, social engineers, and tyrants in all ages would cheer. Quote, "It is right that a person wishing to own a lethal firearm should put forward a good reason." End quote. From the Liberator Online, we have a classic quote on political correctness. Richard Zeller taught for 25 years in the sociology department at Bowling Green State University, but now he's quitting in protest. Why? Because colleagues in his department wouldn't let him teach a course on political correctness that included books critical of campus speech codes, affirmative action, and other politically correct related positions. Professors in other departments also supported the decision not to let Zeller offer the course. Indeed, in what is surely one of the classic PC quotes ever uttered, Kathleen Dixon, the director of the Women's Studies Department, told a local newspaper, quote, "We forbid any course that says we restrict free speech." In a secretive assault on Americans' privacy, the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, is seeking access to confidential Census Bureau records, as well as confidential financial data collected by the Internal Revenue Service. Congressional supporters of the CBO's data grab are attempting to insert into any of the pending appropriations bills language that would authorize the unprecedented disclosure of Census and IRS information. The CBO proposal seeks the data, which is currently kept strictly confidential under federal law, in order to make long-term projections about the viability of the Social Security and Medicare programs. The initiative is being opposed by and publicized by Representative Carolyn Maloney, a Democrat of New York, who has accused the CBO of trying to sneak its proposal through the complex appropriations process currently ongoing as Congress rushes towards adjournment. In a letter sent to leaders of the House Appropriations Committee on October 11th, Representative Maloney said that changing the law that protects the confidentiality of census data in the middle of the 2000 census, behind closed doors and with no public debate, sends the wrong signal to the American public. She cited widespread privacy concerns that were expressed earlier this year after a Census Bureau's long-form questionnaire sought answers to a number of intrusive personal questions. The attempted disclosure is also opposed by the Commerce Secretary Norman Mineta, who told congressional leaders that the proposal would weaken the most important legal structure protecting the privacy and confidentiality of all Americans with regard to the private information they provide on the Census Bureau. Saying that he is adamantly opposed to the proposal, Mineta noted that the CBO's initiative would threaten public confidence in the confidentiality of all information collected by the Census Bureau and other data collecting agencies. According to a coalition of consumer and privacy groups, another last-minute amendment could detrimentally affect personal privacy. Senator Judd Gregg, a Republican of New Hampshire, has attached his Social Security number proposal, Senate 2554, to the Commercial Justice State Appropriations Bill. The amendment would not effectively increase protections over Social Security numbers, but would preempt the ability of states to provide stronger protections on their own. A letter from the consumer and privacy groups opposing the amendment to the Commerce Justice State Appropriations Bill is available at www.perg.org/consumer/gregssn.htm. On September 26, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that presents the question of whether the use of a device that detects heat emanating from a home constitutes a search under the Fourth Amendment. The petitioner, Danny Lee Kylo, was arrested in 1992 by Oregon officials for growing marijuana in his home. To obtain the evidence for the arrest, the police used, without a warrant, a thermal imaging device that detects heat emanations inside a home. After discovering that Kylo's home was warmer than neighboring buildings, police then obtained a warrant and searched Kylo's home and found evidence of criminal conduct. Kylo pled guilty to charges of growing marijuana but challenged the constitutionality of the use of the thermal imaging device, absent a warrant. The case is on appeal from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit Court, which held in a 2-1 decision that the use of thermal imaging technology did not constitute a search. Writing for the majority, Judge Hawkins said that the use of the device was not a search since it did not reveal any intimate details. Further, use of the device did violate any reasonable expectation of privacy since Kylo made no attempt to conceal heat emissions, thus demonstrating a lack of concern with the heat emitted and a lack of subjective privacy expectation in the heat. In his dissent, Judge Noonan responded that it's strange to focus on the homeowner's non-existent expectation as to emissions. The homeowner's expectation is directed to the privacy of the interior of his home. It is that expectation which the Fourth Amendment is intended to protect. While several federal courts of appeals have agreed with the Ninth Circuit's decision that the use of the imaging device does not constitute a search, other district and state Supreme Courts have held that a warrant requirement should apply. Since he's been publishing controversial material since 1984, 2600 Magazine's Emmanuel Goldstein thinks he's in a good position to put things in perspective. And right now, he says, there's an epidemic of legal activity on the part of large corporations like has never been seen before. He got yet another legal threat on October the 18th. This time, General Motors found out that they had registered fuckgeneralmotors.com, and they are demanding that it be turned over to them at once. 2600 is, quote, not authorized, end quote, to use their name, they say. This follows the same twisted logic of the various other corporations who have tried this intimidation tactic against similar sites. This is a little thing called speech, which, when offensive, is entitled to protection. That is one of the reasons why registering such sites is an important act. You can see the utter arrogance of these people who think that they can actually control when and where people ask to speak their corporate name. If that was the only reason for registering such a site, it would be enough. But, said Goldstein, there's more we can do and should be doing. We just don't have the manpower to put together so many different sites. That's why we need your help to do a decent job here. What Goldstein proposes is that for all the sites that he has gotten legal threats over, he'd like to point to some truly decent watchdog pages. For instance, there must be someone out there with knowledge of General Motors and how they've treated their employees unfairly, shutting down plants, or making unsafe vehicles. It should be a clearinghouse of information where others can post their experiences. If you have such a site or plan on setting one up, send email to webmaster@2600.com and they'll arrange to have fuckgeneralmotors.com point to it. The same holds true for any of the other corporations that they have critical domains for. This is an issue of free speech, and we need to send a message that free speech is something we just cannot back down on. Dateline October 13th, 2000. An Internet Civil Liberties group has teamed up with a consumer group to weigh in against the common practice of using unsubstantiated civil lawsuits to determine the identity of a controversial speaker. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, along with the consumer group Public Citizen, filed a motion to quash a subpoena presented to America Online seeking the identity of an anonymous poster absent proof from the plaintiff that the statements made were actually defamatory. The brief was filed on behalf of an individual, Jane Doe, who had made several comments on a Yahoo message board devoted to AK Steel, formerly Armco Steel, based in Middletown, Ohio. Amongst these messages were statements that John Hritz, the executive vice president and general counsel of AK Steel, was too litigious. Hritz promptly filed a petition for discovery, generally alleging that John and or Jane Doe had made disparaging, threatening, and defamatory remarks on the internet. Ohio law allows Hritz to file a petition for discovery even though he has not yet filed a lawsuit against Doe. Hritz then used the petition to issue subpoenas to Yahoo and AOL to identify Doe. EFF and Public Citizen stepped in to combat the growing problem of powerful entities increasingly turning to their lawyers when they find something online they don't like. Loren Gilman, EFF's Director of Public Policy, explained, "This is just one example where the legal system is being misused to chill internet conduct. Lawyers are churning out subpoenas with the sole purpose of intimidating individuals into self-censoring speech. That's especially clear here where Hritz hasn't even filed a lawsuit." The only specific web posting about himself that Hritz cited in his request for discovery is, quote, "Hritz will litigate the time of day. Oops, I'll be in court," end quote. As Doe explains in her brief, not only is this statement purely opinion and hence not actionable as libel, but his filing of the case against Doe seems to substantiate Doe's criticism of Hritz. Doe argues in her brief that because the main purpose of such suits is often to unmask a company's critics, the identification of those critics would be treated as a major form of relief that cannot be awarded without proof of wrongdoing. A company should not be able to deny members of the public the right to speak anonymously by simply making vague allegations of wrongdoing, clarified EFF's legal director, Cindy Cohn. EFF's Gilman explained further, given the complete lack of evidence that Hritz was libeled, his use of the court as his own private detective agency constitutes a blatant disregard for the Supreme Court's ruling that the First Amendment protects Jane Doe's right to speak anonymously. This is unacceptable behavior, especially from a lawyer for a major corporation. This lawsuit is a blatant attempt to intimidate all of AK Steel's employees and other members of the public, said Paul Levy of Public Citizen Litigation Group, who plans to argue the case on behalf of Doe. Hritz is in effect warning workers not to exercise their First Amendment right to speak freely about the company on the Internet. It would be disturbing if courts were to permit the disclosure of identities of people who post messages anonymously, Levy said. The First Amendment guarantees people a right to speak out and to participate in public debates. The message board is just that, an ongoing public debate. The EFF decided to put together a legal team to defend Doe because of the free speech implications of the case. Robert Korn Revere and Ronald Wiltsey of Washington, D.C.-based law firm of Hogan & Hartson and Timothy Connors and Mark Belleville of the Ohio-based law firm of Calfee, Halter & Griswold are also representing Doe as local counsel in the Virginia and Ohio courts, respectively. From the Liberator Online, a 70-year-old Little Rock, Arkansas woman has been arrested, fingerprinted, and threatened with stiff fines for refusing to take burglar bars off the front windows of her house. Betty Dyslinger's 1870s-era home is in Little Rock's Historic District. The burglar bars violate the Historic District's regulations. Mrs. Dyslinger's crimes against humanity extend far beyond the burglar bars. She also faces charges for installing two vinyl windows to replace wooden ones and for having a heating and air conditioning system that can be seen from the street. Yet this criminal remains defiant and unrepentant. Mrs. Dyslinger says she doesn't plan to remove the burglar bars. Quote, the bars were on here when I bought the house in 1998, she says, and if I can find some more, I'll put them on the rest of the windows. I'm alone and I am 70, end quote. Mrs. Dyslinger says she fears crime in the area. Prior to her purchase, the house had been abandoned, trash-filled, and used by prostitutes. The warrant was issued on the complaint of Ann Guthrie, the city's historic preservation administrator. Mrs. Guthrie lives next door to Mrs. Dyslinger. Mrs. Dyslinger describes her arrest as, quote, power out of control, end quote, and she vows to fight back. That's our program for now. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this program, please pass along copies to your friends. If you'd like a higher quality copy for broadcast or archival purposes, please contact me at critter@wizvax.net. Please specify whether you would prefer a 48kbps mono or a 96kbps stereo version of this program. Copies of this program may be available via Napster or Nutella at times. Or you can download them on the web at www.wizvax.net/critter. Thanks for listening.